our worries 10 years ago look modest compared to what we have learned in the last 2 weeks.
With the air still thick from post-leak fallout, the president calls for a national conversation on surveillance. But how and with whom? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Also, a dispatch from the front lines of the battle over fracking.
It's a full-scale war. On one side, you have the oil and gas companies, and on the other, a quite active activist community, and they're basically just screaming at each other.
And a new bill hopes to set limits on emerging technology that tracks your every move.
Suppose you and your wife are watching TV and you're having an argument. A computer at Verizon headquarters could say they're having an argument, and they could flash an ad on the screen for marriage counseling or Prozac.
There's more coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, President Obama sat down with Charlie Rose to discuss, among other things, NSA contractor Edward Snowden's leaks about wide-ranging government surveillance.
What I want to do is to set up and structure a national conversation, not only about these two programs, but also about the general problem of big data sets, because this is not going to be restricted to government entities.
Calling for a national conversation is easy and risk-free. It can be used to class up a celebrity murder trial. We'll never forget OJ, no matter how much we'd like to.
The trial forced a national debate about race and celebrity.
It's great when celebrities get us talking about something worthwhile.
Angelina Jolie did what she set out to do, start a national conversation about cancer and the risk.
You can build a fabulous career on nothing but national conversations if you're really good at it.
Today begins a national conversation on bullying. Right now.
And sometimes national conversation can serve as both a source of solace and a springboard to action.
Now, if Adam Lanza had walked into a black public school in this mythical South Brooklyn, we would probably not be having a sustained national conversation about guns.
What even constitutes a national conversation? Back in 2002, when hackles started to rise after the rushed passage of the Patriot Act, one hardened group of civil libertarians raised their voices in hundreds of communities across the nation, holding community meetings in their own fancy government-subsidized digs. I'm talking, of course, about librarians. Lynn Bradley is the director of the American Library Association's Office of Government Relations. She says that when they started that conversation, their understanding of the extent of the surveillance was at preschool levels. Now,
I'm not sure that we're beyond junior high at this point. We still have a long way to go in terms of having a serious public debate.
How do you have a national conversation? What did you do a dozen years ago to get it rolling?
Libraries of all types had different kinds of debates, programs, informational pieces. By the way, one of the things was to promote resolutions to be passed at the local level by cities, townships, counties, and even a small handful of states, asking for dialogue and to reform and assure that our civil liberties were going to be protected. We've kept up web pages. We've had programs at conferences. We've developed toolkits to help librarians and others have this debate.
There's no unit of measure for raised consciousness. But can you point to any concrete thing that your campaign a dozen years ago did?
Section 215 became known for a long time as the library provision. When you're speaking in generalities, many people in the public would say, well, I don't have anything to hide. If they get my phone records or whatever, what's the difference? But when you say, look, they can get what you read at the library, people would respond like, wait a second, why do they need to know what we read?
This may sound a little defeatist, but you raised the alarm more than a decade ago about the same provision of the Patriot Act and the same worries about transparency. Do you think a new national dialogue
really could influence the implementation of surveillance laws? And where is it most important for that dialogue to happen?
First of all, inside the Beltway and in Congress. If you look at how Congress has oversight, they're not even allowed to take in legal people to look at these secret documents or to take notes. What kind of public analysis can our elected officials have in a system that is so limiting? We are pleased to see that there are those in Congress and elsewhere that are seeking to declassify some of this information so the American public can have such a discussion. Our worries 10 years ago look modest compared to what we have learned in the last 2 weeks.
Lynn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lynn Bradley is the director of the American Library Association's Office of Government Relations. In that Charlie Rose interview earlier this week, President Obama said he hoped the conversation would be helped along by an oversight board.
I've stood up a privacy and civil liberties oversight board made up of independent citizens, including some fierce civil libertarians. I'll be meeting with them.
He met with that board on Friday. But if it's to be the lever for a national conversation, we'll have to take that on faith. Sharon Bradford Franklin is the senior counsel at the Constitution Project, and she says the first version of that board, established by President Bush in 2004, did practically nothing.
It had no independence from the White House, very little authority. It came into existence in 2005 and lasted for about 2 years. In 2007, Congress enacted new legislation to completely revamp the board, to create an independent federal agency within the executive branch with subpoena power, with a bipartisan membership, and all five members who must be confirmed by the Senate. And so created a structure that really could have an impact.
And did it?
Well, the board didn't come into existence for five more years. It took until 2012 to get confirmation of any members. It took until December 2011 to get a full slate of five nominees.
Why was there such a delay in filling out the oversight board, since Obama is at least now evincing such a strong interest in it?
We can only understand that to be a lack of priority. The chair of the board wasn't finally confirmed until just last month. Only the chair is a full-time member of the board. That's his full-time job. And only the chair has the authority to hire a permanent staff. The board is still in startup mode.
So let's imagine a world where this oversight committee is up and running and effective. What can it do?
Okay, it has two overarching purposes. First, evaluate national security programs, proposed ones and existing ones, and to ensure that there are adequate safeguards for privacy and civil liberties. The second is to inform the public. They are required to report to the president and to Congress, and the statute specifically says that these reports should include an unclassified version, and these should be made available to the public to the greatest extent possible.
You've been following the evolution of this board. Do you have faith that it can actually set up and structure a national conversation?
Well, I have faith that it can play a significant and meaningful role. Not only do the board members have security clearances, they have subpoena power. So they will be able to get a full picture of the operation of these programs. Right now, the public is just getting carefully selected disclosures to justify the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sharon Bradford Franklin is senior counsel at the Constitution Project. Everyone seems to agree that there can be no useful conversation, that is, conversation that leads to change, without serious, sincere congressional participation, which doesn't happen, I guess, without voters and the media eating through the entropy on Capitol Hill. Representative Henry Waxman is a California Democrat who truly believes in the power of national conversations
where we have all of the different aspects of our society working together, whether it's in the press and local community meetings, activist groups, to push the agenda forward to see what can be done. That is what I think of in terms of a national dialogue. Now, let me take the issue of climate change. I think this is the greatest threat facing our lives today, yet the Republicans who run the House refuse to hold hearing with the scientists, and then they go out and assert the science does not support climate change.
So you're saying that they're suppressing that national conversation by refusing to hold hearings?
They are trying to do what they can to suppress that conversation and information that the public would otherwise react to with some sense of urgency to make changes. Now we have a very big story on national security, and people are paying attention now in the ways they never did before.
Does national conversation ever lead to consensus?
I do think it does. I think the incidents in the civil rights struggles, when people saw little children being hosed or people being jailed for trying to exercise basic rights, I think it drew a lot of awareness and understanding of a problem that people thought was somebody else's problem somewhere else. And I think our country reacted to it.
Congressman, following the Newtown Elementary School shooting, you were part of a forum for a, quote, national conversation on violence and severe mental illness.
Yes. After the horrific incidents of shooting by deranged individuals, people have a clear sense that there ought to be some background checks before people are able to get any kind of weapon.
And that really worked out well in Congress.
Well, we have 90% of the American people who back that, and yet we have representatives in the Senate and the House who are not willing to support legislation yet. But I don't think the pressure's off.
As a U.S. congressman, how do you determine when a national conversation is taking place?
When my constituents are talking about it and asking me questions, when the press is writing about it, informing the American people, when committees of Congress see that there's a reason to be concerned and start doing either a private investigation and public hearings, when a whistleblower comes forward and talks about what's actually happening.
Are you glad that Snowden leaked what he leaked?
He started a debate in this country and people starting to ask questions. That's worthwhile. He may be a traitor. I don't know the man. I don't know his motivations. But I think that we're drawing more attention to issues that we should have been aware of and should not have had to become informed this way, but that was the way we heard about it.
Without this leak, we would not be having this conversation.
You may well be right, but ultimately what we have to have, not just a discussion, but a call to action to change things if the status quo is too troubling and not productive.
Thank you very much, Congressman.
Thank you.
Representative Henry Waxman is a congressman from California. Coming up, put on your underwear. Your TV can see you. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, and I'm on hold with the office of Republican Congressman Walter Jones. Last week, he and his fellow representative, Democrat Mike Capuano, introduced the We Are Watching You Act, a response to Verizon's attempt back in 2011 to patent a device that would watch you as you watch TV, in order to serve you more relevant ads. Verizon failed to get its patent, but that won't stop this kind of technology. Microsoft has plans to release a new Xbox with a voice and motion sensor that stays on even when your TV is off.
Okay, sorry about that. Here he is.
Okay. Congressman?
Walter Jones speaking.
Hi. So what does the We Are Watching You Act do?
Well, the whole thing is, Mike Capuano, who's a friend of mine, I'm a conservative Republican and he's a liberal Democrat, but we've been friends for 12, 14 years. And he came to me 2 weeks ago and he said, Walter, do you realize that some of the DVRs and TVs will be set up with devices that can, excuse me for saying it this way, but it's the way I see it, spy on the people that bought the product without them knowing it. I said, mm-hmm. I said, Mike, you're kidding me. No, he said, no. He said, I'm going to put a bill in. I said, well, I want to be on it. And what this bill does is say that if you're going to have these products, you must display a sign that explains that the device is in the television or DVR.
We've been talking about how the NSA surveillance program has been running for at least 10 years, and we're just now having a real conversation about it, or at least we're trying to. The technology that you're trying to place some restrictions on doesn't even really exist yet. So this bill is really an effort to jumpstart a conversation.
Well, that's a good way to put it, Brooke. All this really is doing is, in my opinion, is trying to protect the consumer. And let me just read this very quick, this one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
The new technology would watch and listen to consumers with a camera and microphone, determine age and gender, note thermal images, and include facial recognition capabilities. And I'm not an extremist, but that's another example of the federal government authorizing the private sector to get into our business.
Okay, let me comb through that. You wrote, when the government has an unfortunate history of secretly collecting private citizens' information from technology providers, we must ensure that safeguards are in place to protect American rights. So let me ask you,
Sure. Is
this about the fact that these companies might one day have to turn this information over to the government?
To me, as you well know, the distrust of Washington as is as worse as it's ever been. Last week I heard the approval rating of Congress was 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the NSA issue with Mr. Snowden. And Mike and I just said the timing is right. We want the American people to know that we're ready to take the lead and fight with them for their protection of their privacy.
And are you as worried about corporate intrusion as government intrusion?
Well, you never know. Once the camel has the nose under the tent, you never know where it goes. And I know that's a trite statement, but it's true. But if you full disclose to that purchaser of that product that they're going to watch what you do in your living room or bedroom, then that's fine. If you want to buy it, go ahead and buy it. We're not trying to stop the person from purchasing.
Were you conscious of making the title of your bill scary? You know, We Are Watching You?
No, Mike talked with me about it. It was his idea. I said, no, I think that's great. Brooke, sometimes you just have to wake the American people up because people are worried about jobs, keeping jobs, about kids getting out of college, can't find jobs, and just a number of issues. So I'm not being critical, but I'm just saying that we selected that title because we wanted to wake up America.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
North Carolina Republican Walter Jones. Hiawatha Bray is a tech reporter for the Boston Globe with some insight into how Verizon had proposed to use that device, for which it failed to get that patent.
Suppose you and your wife are watching TV and you're having an argument. A computer at Verizon headquarters could say they're having an argument, and they could flash an ad on the screen for marriage counseling or Prozac. And this is in the patent application that Verizon submitted. Conversely, you could have a situation where you're on the couch and you're basically getting romantic. And you could see an ad flash on your TV for contraceptives or an ad for a vacation resort in a romantic location. And it would all be done by computers that are smart enough to recognize the visual and audio signals that you're giving as cues to your emotional and mental state.
So what's real right now?
Microsoft, in 2011, filed a patent for a system that would use the camera on the Kinect, basically to keep track of whether or not you stayed in front of the TV while a commercial was on. If you got up and left the room, it would know. But the reason why they would do it is they would basically say, we can give you rewards, like discounts on Xbox games or free movies on one of our video services, if you sit through the commercial, and the camera will tell us whether or not you did. That's what they had in mind. Again, Let me be very clear on this. Nobody is doing any of this stuff yet. The problem that Representative Capuano and Representative Jones are worried about is that if this starts to happen, it'll just sort of creep up on us. And we won't have a chance to really stop and think about the implications of it until one day we wake up and all our devices are working this way.
What do you mean by all of our devices? Will our toasters soon be watching us for signs of hunger?
Anything that's got electrons running through it can have a little chip embedded in it that gives it a certain measure of intelligence. It's called the Internet of Things. It's a world in which machines talk to each other over computer networks, and they don't even have to have human beings involved.
You mentioned in your piece that Verizon wanted this technology in order to better target their ads. Aren't there some advantages here?
Absolutely. There's no question that there are advantages. We can be safer, more secure. There are so many ways in which this can help us. The question is, where do we want to draw the line in terms of our privacy? The idea that we want to be monitored and analyzed and measured literally every moment of our lives. Some of us find this a little off-putting.
You don't want someone watching you hanging out on your couch watching TV. But
yeah,
what you describe is not a someone, but a sensor who won't be communicating the condition of your boxer shorts to any other human being.
All of this stuff gets recorded. Everything gets saved. They're not necessarily saving, you know, every image that they capture from your living room, but anything that gets captured by any of these sensors gets saved somewhere.
So obviously with NSA surveillance in the news, you have to ask, what happens if the government demands to be shown all this living room footage? Does this act that began this discussion, the We Are Watching You Act, address this question? What does it do?
What they're saying is that consumers, A, need the right to opt out, and B, even if they don't opt out, they need to be aware of what's actually happening. And basically what the act would say is, even if you opt in, whenever this device is actually tracking what you're doing, you will have a box or some kind of image on your TV screen at all times saying, we are watching you. Because you got to remember, say you're sitting at home, you're watching TV, it's watching you. Now your neighbor comes over. Your neighbor didn't sign on for this. What happens when they walk into the living room? Shouldn't they be warned that, you know, somebody's going to notice they're wearing a dirty T-shirt and they're picking their nose or something?
Just to avoid the box on the screen, wouldn't just about everybody opt out? And is that what we want?
Well, that's a good question. And you know, I got the impression from talking to Congressman Capuano that he might be willing to be flexible about this because he made it clear he's not trying to stamp this out. He's just trying to make sure the consumers know what they're getting into. But the other thing to keep in mind is, look at the world we live in now. Once upon a time, people would have said, gee, a computer network where you just go online, you put up pictures of yourself in your most intimate moments, and you tell people the story of your life and everything about yourself so that millions of other people can read it. Nobody's ever going to want to do that. It turns out that people are far more tolerant of revealing facts about themselves than anyone would have thought. And so if they're given this option to opt out, and not just that, if they're given a reward for opting in, there'll be a significant number of people who will say, sure, go ahead.
So how significant do you think this bill is? Is it going to start the conversation?
People all over the country are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, all these companies are collecting amazing amounts of information about us. The government is turning around and demanding that information, and we've got to make sure, A, that the companies secure this information better, B, that they get permission from the consumer before they collect it in the first place, and C, that the government's going to have to jump through a bunch of hoops before they can get it.
Hiawatha, thank you very much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Hiawatha Bray is a tech reporter for the Boston Globe.
This G8 also launched a bold new pro-business agenda to get to grips with the problems of tax evasion, aggressive tax avoidance, and corporate secrecy.
That's British Prime Minister David Cameron at this week's G8 summit of some of the world's biggest economies. He's talking, among other things, about offshore tax havens.
Let's be clear. If you want a low-tax economy, which I believe is fundamental to growth, you have to collect the taxes that are owed. That is only fair for companies and for people who play by the rules.
$21 to $32 trillion are currently held in tax havens worldwide, according to the advocacy group the Tax Justice Network. But that's not why tax havens were discussed at this week's G8. They were discussed because a stupendous 260 gigabytes of incriminating information about them were released in April in a report called Offshore Leaks, generating one headline after another, everywhere but in the U.S. Gerard Ryle is the director of the Center for Public Integrity's International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and he coordinated the Offshore Leaks reporting effort. He says that while the shenanigans detailed in these leaks are not always illegal, they are certainly illuminating, important, and often outrageous.
The Tax Justice Network, which you quoted earlier, they estimate that up to 30% of all world wealth is now held in tax havens. And it's a fact that about half of all world trade goes through there. People wondering why Greece was having issues. It's because people don't want to pay taxes. You avoid taxes by going offshore and playing by different rules. The secrecy allows all sorts of bad things to happen. The Ponzi schemes that have taken place over the last 20 or 30 years, every one of them have gone through tax havens. This is a world that the public never gets to see.
So just what was in this leak?
Well, you're looking at about 2.5 million records, and they're from two offshore providers. These are people that set up offshore entities for people around the world, including banks and big accountancy firms. It's about 30 years of records of these two companies, pretty much everything that they kept electronically.
How did this project begin? You were working on a story for the Sydney Morning Herald?
I was an investigative reporter for many years in Australia. And one of the stories that I came across was a very strange fraud that took place. This guy came along claiming to have invented a pill that if you put it in your motor vehicle, it allows your fuel to last longer. It didn't exist. What he was doing instead is taking money from people, claiming to be about to launch on the British Stock Exchange. But what he was doing is putting all the money into offshore bank accounts and then repatriating that money back to Australia as if it were sales of the product. Once I realized that there was a world out there that could be used in this way, it led to a lot of information about other schemes that were being used to fraud people in the offshore world. And one day I managed to get a hold of these 2.5 million files.
What do you mean you happened to bump into these files? They were, you know, sitting next to you at a bar?
No, they arrived in the post. It was a computer disk full of information. It didn't come as a surprise that I was going to get it, but I quickly realized that there was information in these files from about 170 different countries, and that I had a lot of information that other reporters around the world would really like to know.
So this disk was just sitting there, unexploited for material until you got to the ICIJ in 2011. How did you organize the reporting? How did you roll it out?
So suddenly I had access to the rest of the world. And what I did as part of my job was to get reporters together, tell them about what I had, and start sharing it. In Washington, we had a two-day session where we outlined it all. This was in January 2012. And as we went through the project, it grew and grew to the point where we had reporters in about 40 countries and more than 80 reporters working on it. And by the time we launched simultaneously in 37 different countries.
So give me some of the impact those stories had.
Well, we've managed to get government inquiries in almost 10 different countries, including in the US, in Australia and Great Britain. We had the deputy speaker of the Mongolian parliament, who subsequently had to resign because we found him with not just an offshore entity, but a Swiss bank account with $1 million in it. The biggest banker in Austria, who was in charge of basically spreading loans right across Eastern Europe, has also had to resign because of their connections to this offshore world. They were so big in Austria that they actually set up a special commission called the Offshore Leaks Commission to investigate the names.
And so there it is, all around the world, grabbing headlines, causing scandals, except, it seems, here in the United States. Why isn't it big here, do you think?
It was quite surprising to us. There were about 4,000 U.S. names, and we thought it would have the same resonance here as it has had everywhere else. But I think it's because people here can't get their head around that the story is about the system rather than the big names. When we were going around to the American newspapers with the story, because that's what we do, they just wanted to know about names. Give us a big name. And once the big name wasn't there, they moved on and they weren't as interested in the story.
A week ago Friday, the ICIJ posted a heavily redacted version of this database online. What are you hoping the public does with that?
We were criticized initially by some members of the public for not going far enough, and they wanted more information. So what we have done is we've published a very basic database of the names and the entities that are in these secret files that allows the public to go in there and search, and then allows them then to tell us about it so that we can then publish new stories based on the information that the public finds.
Have you gotten any tips?
We've had about 300 replies in the first 2 to 3 days. We had more than 3 million page views. And yes, we've had some fantastic stories come out of it in countries we hadn't actually been working in. Bangladesh and India, they were the two major big revelations for us. But in fact, there were some very interesting tips coming out of the US. We have to verify what people are saying, but they claim to be identifying fairly high-profile individuals in the US.
Do you see in this a model for future collaborations?
It wouldn't work with every story, but we think in many ways this is a pioneering operation and something that we can repeat, hopefully, over and over again.
Gerard, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gerard Ryle is the director of the Center for Public Integrity's International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Coming up, the argument over fracking heats up, and a conversation with a man who makes his living turning the temperature up or down on hot-button issues. So how do you increase the outrage?
Then your goal is to get them more upset. That's what I sometimes call precaution advocacy. The paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out. This could kill you. Do something. Wear a seatbelt. Wear a hard hat. Wear a condom. Not necessarily all at the same time.
I'm sure it's happening. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, whose commission to build a healthier America works to improve health where Americans live, learn, work, and play. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Fracking, as you probably know, is a controversial method of energy extraction involving pumping tons of water, chemicals, and sand deep into the earth at extreme pressures to release oil or gas from shale rock. The practice makes news on an almost daily basis. Take this week. In Illinois, Governor Pat Quinn signed into law what he says are the strictest state regulations for fracking to date. But in Wyoming, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency abandoned a planned study of fracking's impact on groundwater. Also this week, the EPA announced that a comprehensive report on fracking's threat to groundwater and air, commissioned by Congress in 2010, would be delayed until 2016. And next month, we'll see the HBO debut of the film Gasland 2. The fracking debate took on considerable steam in 2010 when the first Gasland came out, showing Americans who live near extraction sites alongside dying animals, sick children, and flammable tap water.
Whoa, Jesus Christ.
The oil industry was quick to respond.
All energy development comes with some risk, but proven technologies allow natural gas producers to supply affordable, cleaner energy while protecting our environment.
Abram Lustgarten, energy and climate reporter for ProPublica, says that the oil industry and environmentalists are battling hard for control of the fracking story.
It's a full-scale war. When I first began reporting on this, the industry was caught off guard. The response to that has been to develop a very sophisticated public relations campaign. You see this in extensive sponsorship for NPR, for example, full-page ads in newspapers for the natural gas industry, a whole host of non-governmental organizations or lobbying groups that didn't even exist before, America's Natural Gas Alliance, Energy in Depth, the Clean Skies Foundation, and none of these places had even set up offices in 2008. You have gas industry representatives trolling on websites, contributing to chat threads, you know, aggressively engaging in public hearings. Their basic assertion is there isn't hardcore scientific proof that processes associated with drilling are environmentally harmful.
What about the optics of this? There is nothing more arresting than flammable water.
Well, I think you've touched on exactly why that image has become so potent. And most of what we're talking about is stuff that happens thousands of feet underground, risks that might not be manifested for 10 years or 50 years or 100 years. And that presents a unique set of challenges for the media and for communicating about risk in general. I mean, water contamination is a phrase that no one wants to hear. Water blowing up is something that everybody universally knows is just not supposed to happen.
Tell me about the work that you've done in this area.
I'd been reporting on the oil industry for the better part of a decade, and in 2008 was told by a couple of geologists that I was interviewing that there was this process called hydraulic fracturing that was increasingly being used in drilling fields. We went to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, where they were considering permitting drilling in the Marcellus Shale, and found that the environmental regulators weren't familiar with this process. They didn't know what the chemicals would be that were pumped underground, and they didn't really have a plan for treating the waste that would be produced as a result. Those huge gaps in their response really fueled what became a four-year investigation for us, more than 100 stories, probably 15 or so major investigations.
Ever since George W. Bush signed into law the Energy Policy Act of 2005, or as its critics call it, the Halliburton loophole, natural gas companies don't have to disclose, apparently, a single chemical that's injected into the ground. How can you do quality reporting on fracking if you have a legal barrier to reporting that?
Well, that's a very good question. It's actually a bigger question for the scientific community than the journalistic community, in that researchers, you know, water quality experts say that they can't go out and test for contamination if they don't know what they're testing for. Where the media comes in this equation is the industry responded to criticism by creating a voluntary disclosure system called Frac Focus, and it's a website that's contributed to by drilling companies in the places that they drill. The media is latched onto that, repeating the industry's assertion that now there is disclosure and, well, that problem has been taken care of. Now we're starting to finally hear some reports that that disclosure is not necessarily listing the most dangerous chemicals used and still protecting them behind this veil of competitive trade secrets.
What do you think reporters most frequently get wrong when talking about fracking?
Wrapping this entire issue under the phrase fracking, as if fracking alone describes the entire drilling process. You know, fracking is just a couple minutes in the lifetime of a well. In my reporting, I found that the environmental problems from drilling relate to the disposal of waste, the drilling of the well, the preparation, the construction of that well, and then this process itself of fracking. You know, there's also a lot of false distinctions. We see the phrases now shale fracking or horizontal drilling batted around that I think present a false distinction between, you know, the kind of drilling that's happening, say, in Pennsylvania and the kind of drilling that's happened for decades in Colorado. This is something the oil and gas industry has pushed to present the viewpoint that some of the problems that the country's seen out west might not recur back east. And again, it's a reporter's responsibility, I think, to get beyond those sorts of distinctions.
I wonder whether many of these reports about fracking suffer from the same conflict of interest problem as in the early days of reporting about global warming. In fact, some have termed this problem frackademia.
There's consistently been serious conflicts of interest raised about some of the most prominent quote-unquote scientific reports. A couple of recent examples include a University of Texas professor, a former director of the U.S. Geological Survey, who essentially wrote a report saying drilling wasn't a serious environmental threat, and it turns out that he was receiving compensation and had board affiliations with a natural gas company. The MIT Energy Initiative, which is funded by BP, produced a report hailing the benefits of natural gas. Ernie Moniz, who was affiliated with that program, was recently appointed to the Department of Energy. The technical expertise, it's always laid within the drilling industry. I mean, they employ the petroleum geologists who understand the practice best. From the start, there's been, you know, a dearth of scientific evidence, but the drilling industry is using the tiniest little sliver of scientific uncertainty to drive a wedge between, you know, what might seem like a logical question of risk and any sort of certainty or real answers.
So until there's proof, the environmentalists are going to be on the losing side of this issue, even though they have flammable water.
What we see is relatively little action from the federal government. We have a study undertaken by the EPA years ago, which is far from complete. And in the meantime, the rate of drilling has increased. When I began reporting on it, it was just in a handful of states. It's happening in places like Michigan now and Illinois and North Carolina that we hadn't really thought of as oil or gas producing regions. There's obviously a phenomenal amount of activism against fracking, but it hasn't led to any sort of conclusions or answers.
You seem to know as much as anybody, and I just want to know whether you would be comfortable living with this.
I take a kind of pragmatic view. I don't think that we're not going to pursue these resources. I think that it's going to happen. And so the question is, how can you do it most efficiently and most safely and make the wisest decisions about the places where drilling is pursued and perhaps the places where it's forbidden?
Abram, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Abram Lustgarten reports on water, energy, and climate change for ProPublica. In an online forum hosted by The Guardian newspaper this week, NSA leaker Edward Snowden advised Americans to think hard about how much privacy they're willing to trade for security. To make his point, he used an increasingly familiar construction. He said, quote, "Bathtub falls and police officers kill more Americans than terrorism, and yet we've been asked to sacrifice our most sacred rights for fear of falling victim to it." You hear this X kills more than Y construction everywhere. Here's Georgia State Senator Bill Jackson.
There's more murders with hammers last year than there were shotguns and pistols and AK-47s.
That's not true, by the way. Peter Sandman specializes in outrage management. That would be for his industry clients. Also, precaution advocacy for the activists and crisis communication for organizations confronting, say, epidemics or natural disasters. When I called him for an interview, he preferred I came to record him at his home, where I asked him about that X kills more people than Y rhetorical device. He says it doesn't really work.
If you distinguish two characteristics of a risk, how dangerous is it versus how upsetting is it? Let's give them labels. Let's call how dangerous it is hazard. Let's call how upsetting it is outrage. The correlation between hazard and outrage is extremely low. It's about 0.2. What this means is if you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous.
What are the elements that make something terrifying even when it isn't so dangerous?
Trust is a biggie. if I trust you, I'm going to find the risk that you are exposing me to much more acceptable than if I don't trust you. If you trust the government to tell you that surveillance is no big deal and they're going to do it responsibly, you're going to have a different response than if you think the government is not to be trusted. So trust is one. Control is one. If it's under my control, I'm going to be less upset than if it's under your control. Memorability goes in the other direction. If you can remember awful things happening or you can imagine awful things happening, that makes the risk more memorable. That makes it more a source of outrage. But what's key here is that outrage has a much higher correlation with perceived hazard than hazard has with perceived hazard.
But isn't it helpful to set our priorities to know that household accidents, which are preventable, cause more deaths than terrorism?
Yes. It's not like I, go around urging people to ignore hazard and focus on outrage. On the other hand, it's very pointless to go around urging people to ignore outrage and focus on hazard because they won't do it. If hazard is low and outrage is high, that is, you've got a risk that's not very dangerous but is very upsetting, then the job is outrage management. Then you're trying to calm people down. Let's take a situation that most of your listeners are going to think is genuinely low hazard, like vaccination. But if you're at the CDC or you're some public health department and you're dealing with a parent who's anxious, it's not mostly telling the parent that it's foolish to worry about vaccine. It's much more listening to the parent's concerns. It's partly acknowledging that there is some truth to those concerns. The strongest argument in the toolkit of opponents of vaccination is the dishonesty of vaccination proponents about the very small risk that's real. If you're 98% right and pretending to be 100% right, then the advocates of that 2% nail you. When people don't understand the data, it's not because they can't, it's because they choose not to. And that's a function of outrage. So if you can reduce the outrage, then they're more interested in the data. Then you can begin to educate them.
So how do you increase the outrage?
That's what I sometimes call precaution advocacy. The paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out. This could kill you. Do something. Wear a seatbelt. Wear a hard hat. Wear a condom. Not necessarily all at the same time.
I'm sure it's happened.
And there's a variety of strategies, some of them very simple and very obvious.
Give me an example.
One of the things that demonstrably works well with seatbelts and well and generally in precaution advocacy is scaring people. So those scary driver's ed movies that, they make teenagers watch actually do a lot of good. Role models work. One of the most effective things in persuading people to get vaccinated against the swine flu pandemic a couple of years ago was when President Obama got his children vaccinated. One example of a strategy that's very powerful is if you can get people to do a behavior that doesn't necessarily make sense to them because they don't have the attitude to support that behavior. Once they have done the behavior, they begin to wonder why they did it. This is called cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is a very strong motivator for learning things that you wouldn't otherwise want to learn. A nice example of this is most people who have ever tried to ask people to sign petitions notice that more people sign your petition and then read your literature than read your literature and then sign your petition. They sign the petition to be courteous, and then the act of signing the petition makes them wonder, what did I do? What did I sign? Then they read the literature in order to teach themselves that what they did made sense and to develop an attitude that supports the behavior.
Now let's take today the argument over NSA surveillance. Where would you come down on this?
Well, it would depend on who my client was, I guess. If you are the NSA, you have two possible things you can do. One is to ramp up the outrage about terrorism. And the other is to ramp down the outrage about surveillance. And you can see the government trying to do both.
I was thinking that the government's best move would be to offer actual stories of plots that were foiled through this kind of surveillance.
Which, as you know, it's in the process of doing. Whether they're actual stories or fictional stories remains to be determined. But they are telling us stories.
So now, let's say you're working for civil libertarians who have long spoken about the lack of transparency when it comes to these kinds of surveillance techniques.
I'm not going to want to focus on telling people they're fools to worry about terrorism. I would make much more progress telling people that the privacy worries that they have suppressed. I mean, it's not like people don't care about privacy. People do care about privacy. And I would try to reawaken those worries. So I'm talking about this means you. You know, you don't say anything on the phone that you're worried about the government knowing. But here are the ways this might get in your way. The government is doing it now about terrorism. Maybe they're going to be doing it in 10 years about tax evasion. And suddenly it occurs to you that you weren't entirely honest about your taxes. And could they find that out from an algorithm grounded in all the data about your phone calls and emails? And you begin to think, oh, I would be trying to make real, emotionally real, real in outrage terms for people that invasion of privacy isn't something they shouldn't care about.
One more question for you. Fracking. The industry seems to be winning this issue. What would you do for the other side?
I would focus on uncertainty. Who knows? Maybe it can be done safely. But they don't know that for sure. And this is the same industry that got this right wrong and got this wrong and got this wrong and got this wrong. Some of these companies are losing their shirts on shale gas exploitation. And what do companies do when they're not making as much money as they promised their shareholders they were going to make? They cut corners.
And if you were the industry?
Well, for one thing, if I were the industry, I wouldn't be cutting corners. I would be saying, look, this may be more dangerous than wind, but nobody knows how to produce enough power with wind to power your stereo, much less your car. So maybe renewables are the future. Maybe they're not the future. We don't know that. What we know is they're not the present. So our choices in the here and now are gas, oil, coal, and nuclear. And you got to decide which one you hate the least. And you know, there's a very good case that the one you hate the least, especially if you're an environmentalist that's worried about all the wars we've been fighting for, you know, in the Middle East, you start thinking, oh, well, what I really want is a source of energy that's domestic and isn't coal. That's the argument I'd be making.
I can see why you have such a nice apartment. Peter, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Peter Sandman is a risk communication consultant. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Molly Buckley and Olivia Weitz. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.